something happening here. But what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
Welcome back to the Traumedy Podcast. Another incredible episode coming in just a minute. It's Ken Allen saying, howdy doody time. Hey, I've been having a ball doing this. Thanks again for listening. Thanks for going to iTunes. And thanks for giving me some reviews, giving me a couple of stars, a couple of nice words. I appreciate it. All you got to do, you're already downloading it from iTunes, Traumedy Podcast. You just take the arrow, you slide it up to where all the stars are. Boom. All the way to the right. Little arrow becomes a pointy icon, little hand. Go to all five. Boom. Kenneth, scoring, because you're scoring. Thank you, and you're welcome. And vice versa to you. It means a lot because we're starting to get notifications that people are listening and that the numbers are getting up there. Slowly but surely, but I haven't really pushed it too hard. So far, it's just going out to the first responders. And it's making its way through grassroots advertising and word of mouth. And that's what I love about it, is that it's a labor of love for me. And people are hearing about it because they enjoy it and they're telling their friends. So thank you for passing on the word. Thank you. It means a lot to me. And it means a lot to everyone out there that's listening and that, you know, wants a little something interesting to listen to while they're spending those long, dark nights on the ambulance. Case in point, this is one of, I think, the most influential podcasts I've had so far, because I believe so much in this foundation that I'm going to be volunteering some of my time to help out with it. I have on Chris Warren, who is a retiring San Jose police officer who is now in the transition period from retirement to establishment of a foundation, the First Responder One Foundation. And it's going to be for first responders, caregivers, paramilitary individuals like police officers and firefighters and EMTs and paramedics, nurses, even doctors, who have had some kind of critical incident in their job. They've had some kind of high-stress situation that they are now dealing and having trouble dealing with. And so they're going through a lot of things. And the goal for him is to set up a network online to get these people treatment, to show them the kinds of treatment they can get, to have a database of psychologists and psychiatrists that specialize in critical incident stress management, to have established podcasts on it with group therapy of different people that are going through this, potentially webisodes, and then have some kind of internet blogging system just where you can go on and you can talk to other people that are in that kind of profession, that are also dealing with things that you just need to contact and just say, hey, I had some shit happen to me the other day. Who's out there? Anybody want to talk? Ideally, they're going to have it set up so that you can get in touch with hotlines and be able to speak to people either by phone or by web chat. Can you see the potential for this, ladies and gentlemen? It's really a really good thing. And it's a nonprofit. It's really going to be beneficial for us caregivers out there. At some point in your life, you're going to have this if you work in this profession. And even if you don't, you're going to have some kind of stressful situation that you just can't shake. And it goes through your head and it plays with your mind and you can't sleep and it changes your patterns. And maybe you're drinking more. Maybe you're more irritable with your friends and family. And look, let's not put them through it. Let's just get the treatment. Let's go talk to somebody, get the care, and get over it, you know, work through it. And if you can, then you bring that story, you bring that example of overcoming a traumatic situation to other people, and you can help them out, and you can become a counselor. Whatever you want to do. Look, I've had a couple of stressful things happen to me. I've not been trained in counseling, but I know how to do podcasts, and I know how to set up the media for this. So guess what I'm doing? I'm setting up and I'm doing what I can for this because I truly believe in this foundation. And if you're interested in First Responder One, get in contact with me. Leave something on iTunes or leave it on the website itself, www.traumatypodcast.com. Leave a blog, leave a message, whatever you're interested in. If you want to help out, we're always willing to take more help in. We're all caregivers by nature. You know we're always on duty. Give a little handout. Every time you do, you get it back. And that's so rewarding to get it back. And I really appreciate Chris Warren, and I thank him for coming on. Just so you know, he's been contacted by NPR. He's going to be on there in the next couple weeks, and I will let you know when that's going to happen. Also, he has been in contact with TED Talks, and he will probably be on that fairly quickly. So we were able to get our hands on him first and get the message out. This is going to be big. This is really going to be fun. So get ready. This is a good interview. We start off the interview in medias res, as we would say in the literary field. It's kind of in the middle of the conversation of me speaking with Chris about what incident sparked all of this in him. Chris Warren, ladies and gentlemen.
It starts when you're always afraid. Step out of line, the man come and take you away. We better stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going now. Stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going now.
It's kind of interesting when I started, got the idea of First Responder One. It didn't really come to me after I went through the West Coast post-trauma retreat. The whole thing, the reason I kind of went to this thing was back in 2006. We got a call at midnight. I was working midnights as a field training officer. And I'm chatting with my sergeant. I had a recruit. And this call came out saying that this young man who was just got back from Iraq had put on his dress uniform and had taken a rifle into the bathroom and locked the door. Mm-hmm. And he had made comments that he was going to kill himself. So I told my recruit, I said, hey, you know, we ought to go over and see this. Be a good experience for you. So we went over there and pulled up and walked up to the scene where the other officers were. And I see one officer's on a cell phone, and I get up there, and he looks at me, and he goes, well, you're a CIT officer, right? And I go, yeah, I am. He said, well, here, you need to talk to this guy.
Mm-hmm. So you walk up, and he goes, here, grab this.
Yeah.
And you knew a little bit what was going on before.
Yeah, all
you heard the radio report.
That's it. But I didn't know any detail behind it and so forth. So I got on the phone, and I start talking to this young man, and he's crying, and he's upset, and I'm using the standard terms, you know, you don't want to do this, and tell me a little bit about yourself. And so he started talking to me, and he said he was a Marine. He just got back from Iraq. He had just done his first tour. And when he got home, his girlfriend told him, you know,
kaput.
Goodbye.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
excellent. Great way to come home.
Yeah. So here's a kid who came back from a war at 19, and girlfriend tells him, I'm done. He goes into the bathroom and is going to kill himself.
Okay.
So we're talking for a while, and he said that he had had an AR assault rifle, AR-15, and he had gotten some armor piercing rounds. And I don't know if you know armor piercing rounds. They go through your vest.
Well, not like okay. So you guys are afraid for yourself. I was
right.
Gonna say, not like you need it for your head, but
right.
So you're already out there on a standoff.
Right.
Basically saying, if it's going through armor plating,
yeah,
it's going through our Kevlar.
Yeah, and that changes the whole dynamics of a police operation.
Right.
It goes to a tactical versus a, you know, a person's locked in the bathroom.
A suicide prevention type of thing.
Yeah, correct. So we talked for a while, and he told me that he saw things in Iraq that I would never even imagine.
Mm-hmm.
And I told him that's not necessarily true.
Yeah.
You know, I was in the Navy during the Vietnam War, and
saw
a few things. I never went into combat, but I saw a lot of caskets coming home and things like that. But yeah, I never saw what he probably saw.
Mm-hmm.
But I used being in the Navy against him, because being a Marine, because there's just a natural conflict between the two of us, because we're all in the same group.
Yeah,
but one always says they're better than the other. So I started telling him jokes about kidding him about being a Marine, and he started laughing, and I thought, got him. I got the connection. And we he really opened up after that. And we talked about his mom. And the minute we started talking about his family life, he'd start crying again. Mm-hmm. So I knew there was something deep-rooted on that side. So we kept on talking and laughed and cried. But lasted about 42 minutes exactly because I pulled the tapes to see how long it was.
Yeah.
And at the very end, he started taking very long pauses, big, deep breaths. And that's something you kind of I kind of missed. And that was a real clue when he'd do that. Mm-hmm. And then
what's it mean? They're setting up to do something. They're making decisions.
They're making the final decision. Mm-hmm. And the last thing he said in a very, very calm and very distinct voice changed his whole attitude, kind of changed. It was kind of like decision time. And very calmly he said to me, "I wish I had a father like you." And I was standing outside the apartment, and I could see the bathroom door through the window. And all of a sudden, I see this huge, bright flash around the edge of the door. Mm-hmm. And I remember seeing the glass vibrating back and forth, and then I heard the sound of the rifle. Mm-hmm. And the phone then hit the floor. And I immediately knew.
Yeah.
He had pulled the trigger. Mm-hmm. He had killed himself. And my head started spinning. I mean, I was just like, I couldn't believe he did what he did. I mean, I couldn't believe that I actually let that happen. That was my feeling.
Right, that's what you're thinking, right?
Yeah.
You know it's not your, but...
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
That's a hard thing for any caregiver, any of us to think.
Yeah.
We were on the line, we had an ability to change this potentially, and we couldn't.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I had lost control. I was no longer in control of the situation. He made the decision and took control. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I remember going and talked to my sergeant, and he just kind of looked at me and said, "Well, that's the way things go."
Right.
He actually gave me a cigar, and I don't smoke, and I kind of it kind of threw me, but my head was spinning so bad. I was just like, I smoked it.
Right.
Maybe almost made me sick. But for a few minutes, but then I went back down, and so I just kind of threw it away, and I went down, and I saw the lieutenant. And the lieutenant had a look in his face that was just like horror. Mm-hmm. He looked at me like, "Oh my God, what a horrible thing for you to happen." But he didn't say anything to me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so the next thing they asked me to do is go tell his girlfriend what happened.
Great.
Yeah. And she was sitting in the back of the police car. Of course, she went completely sideways.
Mm-hmm.
So that didn't help things. So then after the incident was over, they told me to go back to the police department because I was working at midnights, and it was probably about 4 in the morning now. And they told me I needed to write my report. Mm-hmm. So me and my recruit went back. I wrote the report. And then we have a crisis management unit, a couple people. And they just handed me a pamphlet. And they said, "Well, if this seems to bother you, here is an 800 number you can call."
Uh-huh, yeah.
So I went home and I tried to sleep and did not sleep for the entire day. And then I had to go back on duty the next night.
Mm-hmm.
And probably should not have gone to work. Probably should have taken the day off. But it didn't stop there.
Did you, at that point, did you know this was going to be this significant in your life? Like, was it already just veering you off the normal path that you were on? Or were you just kind of going, "Boy, I can't shake this feeling. Like, I wonder why I can't sleep." Or, you know, how long is this stuff going to go on before I'm back to normal? Or back to the way it was before this call, anyway?
I didn't know, to be honest with you. I thought I was okay.
Mm-hmm.
But I kept seeing this event, reliving this event over and over in my mind for about 3 months.
Okay.
And my sleeping patterns just went down, continually spiraled down. I probably slept maybe 4 hours a night, broken sleep. Mm-hmm. And the minute I go to sleep, I'd start dreaming this thing all over again. And then I would wake up and then I would go, "Well, what if I did this?"
Mm-hmm.
And this went on, like I said, for 3 months.
Right.
So at the three-month mark, I remember it just kind of started fading away.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't really I kind of buried it mm-hmm. with work. Kept working more and more. So this is in 2006.
Okay.
So over the course of, say, before I started talking to someone, it was about 6 years. And I noticed over the 6 years that, and I didn't really realize this till I started talking to people, they kept saying to me, I was always, why are you so grumpy? And I actually, guys were starting to call me grumpy. And I couldn't understand why. Well, I'm not grumpy.
Yeah.
But apparently I was. Apparently I had a very bad attitude. And my attitude was getting worse as time.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife would try to talk to me, and I would say, there's nothing wrong with me.
Mm-hmm.
And then one night, she's trying to push me along because I guess I was being very bad or angry. And she kept pushing me and pushing me, and then I just blew up. Mm-hmm. I mean, I didn't hurt her or anything.
No, right.
The way I screamed at her and the look in her eyes mm-hmm. just kind of like shocked me myself. I kind of went, whoa. The look in her eyes was just revealing to me.
Yeah.
It was just like, I shocked myself. And I said to myself, mm-hmm. You need to really talk to somebody.
Yeah.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to the police department. They gave me a list of places to call and go see somebody. And it took, so the first one was a disaster because the woman knew nothing about PTSD mm-hmm. and or critical incidents. And I want you to cut out the section of PTSD. I shouldn't have said that.
Oh, yeah.
I don't
okay.
want that.
Well, but it's a good thing to bring up is that it's not called PTSD anymore. They're
right.
changing it around. It was a PTSI injury.
Yeah, so, yeah, yeah. But
post-traumatic stress injury. That's,
right.
That's an important change.
I think so, too.
In the categorization of it, absolutely.
Yeah, because it's not, it's definitely an injury to the brain. Because
yeah.
they're starting to see now that it chemically changes the brain. From the incident.
Just and the different hormone levels and everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
A lot of people do.
It goes right to the limbic system.
Mm-hmm.
It reacts immediately with the reptilian brain, I have to kill something or run away, you
mm-hmm.
know.
Mm-hmm.
And you just get hardwired for that event to any kind of stimulant, any stressor in the external that reminds you remotely of that feeling,
yeah.
of that event. Triggers that brain, that reptilian part of your brain to, rah, you know,
yeah.
lash out.
Yeah.
And go crazy.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Momentarily, yeah.
Because actually, I forgot to mention that in 2007, I went to the homicide crime scene unit.
Oh, okay.
So I spent 3 years there stepping over dead bodies and seeing uh-huh. some horrific things in my mind. Mm-hmm. And the smell I went to a lot of suicides.
Yeah.
And I just said after 3 years, I can't do this anymore. And I stepped away. And that's kind of unusual for me.
Yeah.
Because I can handle a lot of different things. But this, for some reason, this really started to wear on me. So I went back into the streets and worked patrol again.
Do you think that you went to the crime, the unit you went to?
The homicide. The crime scene unit and homicide.
I mean, that's directly a year after this whole event took place. Do you ever draw any correlations between the event and then your decision to go into that unit?
I don't think so.
Or another move into another spot?
No, I don't think so. I think you just move into another spot.
Okay.
Because that type of work really intrigues me.
Because
mm-hmm. it's such a puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
But it did definitely affect me.
Yeah,
you know,
sure. Affect any healthy individual
right.
on a regular basis.
Yeah.
Even though we claim it won't, we're tough.
Oh, we're full of garbage.
Exactly.
And the bad thing of being a cop, we won't talk about it.
Right.
We don't talk it about amongst our peers
mm-hmm.
because it's a sign of weakness.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is we're always afraid they're going to take away our gun because they're going to think we're crazy.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I'm going to do the California 5150 hold on you.
Right.
Which is not the case.
Right. Of course not.
Yeah,
but that's the fear that drives you to stay afraid.
Right, right. So you wait till it gets to a point, it festers, and then it's too late. So it's kind of a catch-22 type
course.
Thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In fact, that's exactly what Catch-22, the book, was about.
I remember that. Yeah, yeah.
If you were crazy enough to fly 22 missions, they'd throw you out. But if you said you were crazy and you were losing it, you were smart enough to know. You were in danger of going crazy, so you had to fly the 22 missions.
I remember that, yeah.
What a great book.
That was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So sorry to throw you off track. So you were talking about the fact that you went back into the streets after being in a homicide crime scene.
Yeah. And that's when everybody kept calling me grumpy and so forth, mm-hmm. and then the incident with my wife. Mm-hmm. So I did go see someone. Mm-hmm. Like I said, the first one was this lady was clueless. Mm-hmm. She was more interested in knowing on what's going on in the department than really me. And so I got said, she's out. Let's move on to the next one. The next one was just no connection. I couldn't connect with them at all. Mm-hmm. And then finally, the third one I found up in Concord, which is interesting for what I find is most of the first responder support groups are up in the Northern California. Hmm. They're Northern Novato, Napa, in those areas. South Bay is very limited on people who understand first responders with critical incident issues. Yeah.
Well, any reason why?
Don't know.
We got the VA down here.
No.
I mean, there's one in San Francisco.
But they only support military.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyhow, so I went up and started seeing this gentleman up in Concord. Mm-hmm. Fabulous guy.
Great.
Just fabulous. And the reason I said he was fabulous is because he found out a little bit about me. Mm-hmm. Who's Chris Warren? I mean, what is he like before even becoming a police officer? So we got in some very interesting conversations about that and growing up and everything else.
Right.
And he recommended, he did a bunch of tests, you know, the old look at the ink spot type stuff. Mm-hmm. And he recommended that I go up to the West Coast Post-Trauma Retreat in Napa. And that was really the turning point for me. Mm-hmm. I went through there and it was really a point of, after I walked out on Friday, it was like somebody took 100-pound sack of concrete off my back. I came out with the attitude that there's more to than police work. Mm. I'm okay. I'm normal. Mm-hmm. I'm not alone. That's really key for mm-hmm. first responders.
Absolutely.
Everybody thinks that they're the only ones.
Right.
No, I'm the only one this happened to. Well, that's a bunch of BS. You know, there's a lot of us out there. Mm-hmm. And I think we would be more successful at it if we did talk about it mm-hmm. as police officers. Because one of the things I noticed, I go back now as a peer counselor, and they have a group every month, one which has seven people in the group.
Seven people gaining that are, treatment or that are, help?
Well, they're called clients. And they come up, and they're because it's an educational process, too. They mm-hmm. teach you things like what is a peer counselor also, because they're looking to get you to become a peer after you've attended.
Sure.
So being a peer counselor now, I'd go back up there and I'd watch, and I see it would be like every session I'd go to, it's like a repeat of the last session. Everybody has the same kind of problems. They're no different than the rest of us, mm-hmm. which is really an interesting thing to see.
That's what you're saying. You kind of narrowed it down to like seven different things people are dealing with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What were they?
If I can remember, usually it's childhood, growing up as childhood.
Some kind of dysfunction in childhood.
Alcoholism.
Yeah.
Drug abuse. Mm-hmm. Suicide. Suicide's a big one. Mm-hmm. Usually comes down to family, growing up. And then being in the military and being overseas, seeing the things they saw.
Yeah.
And cumulative, a lot of it's cumulative too. You had did a 25, 30-year degree, career, mm-hmm. and you saw all this stuff and people dying, and you had no control of it. So a lot of the times it comes down to control.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It makes sense.
Yeah.
I mean, especially for caregivers, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I used to think, you know, I think a lot of caregivers would tell you they're not afraid of the blood and gore. They're not afraid of this stuff. That's why I got into this. I like saving it. I'm not afraid of life-threatening issues.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's just the opposite. I think that you're so terrified of this stuff that you've made it your life to try and conquer it every day that you go to work, mm-hmm. in some cases.
Yeah.
You know, it's so frightening to you to be out of control that death is easily, it can happen at any time. It's that random, it's tragic, that a lot of us get into it just because we want to be able to stop it at any point. We want to be able to anticipate it, maybe see it and catalog the warning signs in patients that we've seen.
Yeah.
So that we're watching out for ourselves or our families.
Yeah.
I mean, that's another possibility to this too. And I think what really screws us up is the loss of control in a scene. The loss of...
Yes.
That ability to... You couldn't get to them in time. That's what drives me crazy. And I don't get afraid of that. I get frustrated. I've noticed that's how it manifests with me. Not so much fear, but I think the fear is what the impetus for frustration and then anger and resentment that I couldn't do something later.
Right, right. And that builds. And
right.
The other main issue is the support of your city or command staff. I've seen a lot of first responders feel that they've been left behind or pushed out. Mm-hmm. If they're on a workers' comp case or something like that, they don't understand that the stress of you being viewed as in a negative way because you got injured, you went out on workers' comp.
Yeah.
That you're treated like you're a criminal almost.
Yeah, you're milking the system. You're
right.
Not part of the game, and yeah, you're not part of the guys anymore.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's very difficult for a first responder because, especially from the day you go into an academy like fire, police, or EMT, paramedic, whatever. You drink the Kool-Aid. You're told that you're within the family, and we will take care of you. You know, don't worry about it. You know, your brothers and sisters in blue or whatever will come and we will take care of you. That's true if you're killed, but if you're injured or anything else, it's completely the opposite. Even when you retire after 30 years, I've seen clients go through this process. They think that their friends will call them and they'll go play golf and that continuing other family will take care of you and then all of a sudden within a month or two nothing,
right?
Nobody calls you, nothing. I mean, since my injury, there's probably been 3 people who have actually come and seen me. There's only one officer on the department that calls me every week to see how I'm doing. And nobody in my... And he's the only one from my police academy.
Jeez.
So,
good guy.
He's a great guy.
Yeah.
You know.
And you obviously had a better connection than anybody else. I mean, he gets you and he knows what it's really about.
Right. Because he's been there too. He's been in 2 shootings. So
gotcha.
He right. understands. And I understand he wants to talk too.
Sure.
So, and he'll listen. And he wants to see how I'm doing. So
that's great.
Yeah.
It's good to have.
Yeah.
And along these lines, like you were explaining 2 things. So the injury that you're talking about right now is a physical injury that's taking you out, or is this,
yes.
this is something entirely different?
No, it's physical injury. I've got a neck injury and I've got a knee injury, and
right.
So and I got a right shoulder injury. So
on top of everything else, you're also just getting beaten up from the job.
Yeah, every way.
And in terms of people in the department taking care of or setting up ways for you to get care and treatment. You mentioned what it was like when you came back to the station after this suicide, and they gave you a pamphlet with an 800 number.
Right.
So today, if you feel like you need to call them, how would you rather that go for anybody else in the future? How would you have wanted it then?
Well, there is a system in place. It's a crisis management unit. And the thing would have been, the way it should have gone is they should have taken me and debriefed me right away. Mm-hmm. I should have been able to see a psychologist right away without having to wait. talk with the other officers that were there at the time. I know one other officer who was standing next to me. She's had some issues with it also. Mm-hmm. First do a debriefing, an extensive debriefing, and go over, just kind of share with everybody else how they felt. Did it go well? Did what do you feel? How do you feel? Who took care of the girlfriend and the mom who were there and that type of thing?
Yeah.
Just kind of just lay it out on the table. Mm-hmm. And then once that, it's automatic psychological support. Mm-hmm. You know, clinician, psychologist, whatever. Mm-hmm. Give you a couple months of just going and talking to somebody about it. I think you would have avoided 6 years of having to think about it and deal with it, because you don't know what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
If somebody had told me the signs and symptoms of stress from a critical incident, I'm a smart person. I could sit there and read these things and go, ooh, I got that one. I got that one. I got that one. You know, before it builds up to a point.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. It seems like just sitting around in groups, that first debriefing, mm-hmm. It kind of spreads. Everyone realizes, you know, I feel bad that I couldn't save this person. Hey, I feel that way too. And mm-hmm. I feel, so you kind of are able to almost share in that feeling. Not so much that it's your fault that mm-hmm. you need to take that responsibility, but that it's a common feeling for anybody where that happens. So it maybe kind of diffuses that initial guilt or that initial feeling of having no power.
Yeah.
And then just to have a psychologist speak with you and say, all right, so you went through this. Here are some things that you should be looking for in the next couple months, because mm-hmm. it's probably going
to
come up.
Right. Right. Exactly. But, yeah. Here's what to expect.
Okay.
You know, it's normal. Don't worry about it. You're going to get angry. You're going to relive this situation mm-hmm. over and over and over again. You're going to have a guilt feeling about it, that type of thing. If you knew those things, mm-hmm. I think you could cope with it much better. You know,
yes,
I right. mean, one thing that I remember specifically that one of the people said when I was going with the retreat, he said, that was a horrible thing. That is horrible for you to go through.
Mm-hmm.
And it validated my feelings right then and there. It said, yeah, that's what I kept saying. This is a horrible thing. And why do I feel this way? And once they said it was a horrible thing, you are a normal person, you know, this is a natural reaction, then you wouldn't have had that guilt feeling. You would have understood. And I think that's where we fail. We don't talk about it openly and say, that's a crappy thing you just went through.
Right.
I'm sorry you had to do that. You did everything you did. You did the right thing. No matter what you did, you were not going to stop that suicide. And that's the key.
Right.
You can't control it. Mm-hmm. That person's in control.
That wasn't your decision.
Right. A psychologist showed me she has this little tool called the donut. And I really kind of went, everybody looks at her like, the donut? What the heck are you talking about? Well, you're all cops. We know what donuts
you get a
are.
Donut, right.
Yeah, exactly.
That's actually brilliant.
It is brilliant. It was brilliant. So simple how she put it. She goes, the hole, the center of the donut is you. And the meat or the bread of a donut is all everything around it. And the only thing you can control in the center is you.
Mm-hmm.
You can control your emotions, your thoughts, your feelings, what you're going to do, how you're going to react. But you can't control everybody else around. You can't control their feelings, their actions, what they're going to do, or anything like that. And you sit there and you go, you're right. Cops are in control. Cops sit there and go, if we go to a scene, we're in control. You do this, you do that. You don't do that, you go to jail, you know, type thing.
Right.
But this was something I could not control.
Right.
Because that person was in control of their center, of their donut.
Their donut.
And they didn't care about me whatsoever. Yeah, or what I said or anything else. And so that was the realization.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually use that donut a lot now. Today, I see other people struggling. And I tell them a donut theory. And they go, wow, that makes a lot of sense. You know.
Yeah, yeah.
So when I got done with the first responder or the retreat. On Friday, you leave as a very cohesive group of men and women. There's seven of you. you're like, you had just shared your entire life with them.
Yeah.
The deepest, darkest secrets, everything about your parents. You know, I mean, it's just, you just opened up. And now you're leaving on Friday, and you're being thrusted back out into the world. And it didn't hit me till about a month later. I go, we had a great connection.
Yep.
We've lost that connection. There's got to be a way to make this connect, to stay connected,
yeah,
and be
right.
part of the group, because it really opened my eyes. It made me understand people who suffer from critical incidents and how they feel and so forth. And you go back to the world, the world's gonna crush down on you again, and you're gonna let that all take place. And I kept in touch with the group that I went through. And I could tell that they were starting to feel the crush again,
mm-hmm.
the pointing of the fingers and the lack of support from your command staff or your supervisors. And so I came up with the idea of First Responder One.
Okay.
And that's where the connection would begin. And I've talked to other groups like Safe Call, and I've explained my business plan to them, and they said, that is an amazing plan, and it's the missing link.
Fantastic.
And you go, you're absolutely right. So the goals of First Responder One is to first provide funding. Funding for those people. There's a lot of cities and municipalities and agencies and counties. They do not pay for any type of psychological services or support groups for employees, which is wrong. Yeah. And First Responder One is not just for police and fire. I want this for paramedics, EMTs, correctional facility officers, forest rangers, anybody that works in the capacity of a first responder.
Mm-hmm.
So our goal is to pay their $3,000 fee to go to the retreats. And there's one on the East Coast and one on the West Coast. And then also pay their airfare, because everything's inclusive for the retreat. So they only once they go in, they're not let out till Friday, and everything, their meals, which is fabulous, the food. Oh my God!
Really?
Oh,
great.
It's phenomenal.
just for the food.
Oh, I go back there just to eat the food.
It's great.
And then after that, we then provide the connection for them. There's groups around the United States called First Responders. It's based on Alcoholics Anonymous. It's kind of like the same idea, because a lot of first responders are alcoholics, and they're abuse various drugs and so forth. And coming into the first responder groups, that provides them the support they need to get off alcohol,
okay,
or to get out of drugs, or to get help. Or to come in and the other group members sit there and go, you need to go to the retreat. You know,
right.
you need help. So each of these groups vary from 6 to 12 people. And like I said, they're all over the United States. One of the goals is to link all of these various groups with a data backbone where they can do video conferencing.
Okay.
They can either do it group to group, individual to individual, or and then we can do podcasts.
Mm-hmm.
We can do video training. We can do can't remember what they call them. The train.
You can do lectures. You can do online.
Yeah. There's all sorts of media
like
things.
Conference calling is that what you're talking about?
Yeah.
For educational videos.
Right. Right.
I think it's fantastic.
And link them together, and then I also want to link them to the group called Safe Call, and where, you know, too many times, and this is one of the other things, if you're in crisis, I mean, you're suicidal, or you're in trouble emotionally, you're spinning out of control, talking on the telephone makes it difficult to see someone and read their face. It's like an email.
Mm-hmm.
You make your own interpretations, or you're on the phone, you make your own interpretations because you can't see the facial gestures.
Mm-hmm.
It would be amazing if you could have somebody call in who's in crisis who could actually see each other and talk to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there would be a faster and a better connection between the individuals. immediately.
So they would be basically, instead of calling a hotline, they would be on like a web chat online to a care professional, like a CIT.
Right.
Someone that can immediately talk and visualize and just say, okay, what's going on, what happened.
Right.
So there's still anonymity.
Mm-hmm.
You still have, you know, the patients are just speaking with trained professionals that are required to keep their information private.
Yes.
But you're having face and voice at
right.
conferencing.
Right.
Amazing.
And, yeah.
Great, amazing idea.
Yeah, and it would be all totally confidential. Confidentiality is extremely important to all of us.
Mm-hmm.
And it'd be like the same as HIPAA laws.
Sure.
I'm sorry. Is
it HIPAA?
HIPAA, I'm sorry.
HIPAA, yeah.
So that connection would make it so much better.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's from experience. Because when I was talking to that young man, I wish I could have seen his face,
mm-hmm.
and he could see mine.
Because
mm-hmm. I think he would understand faster. Because he said, well, one of the comments he made to me, well, you don't know what I've seen. And I kind of chuckled because I said to him, I said, you don't know how old I am and what I've seen.
Yeah.
So I think that was a real key right there.
Yeah,
and I think I could have, well, I shouldn't say I could have talked him out of it, but... But I think the connection would be really well, go really much better.
Yeah. I can see the potential for it being such a better, faster, more instant kind of treatment, to be able to recognize.
Right.
Literally, facially recognize.
Right.
And emotionally recognize their state.
Right. And the other thing is that there are a lot of people out there in crisis or have problems and just want to talk. Because
mm-hmm.
I've noticed because I openly tell people I went to this retreat. And I'm not afraid to tell people this because it helped me so much.
Mm-hmm.
And I talk about it. And then maybe in a group, no one says anything to me. But then maybe about an hour later, one of the people come up and say, you know, I had this happen to me and it kind of bothered me. Boom, the connection's there. I've got a person coming in. I mean, I've talked to both my sons are paramedics. Mm-hmm. They tell people about me. And it's not uncommon I get a phone call at least once a week from a paramedic or an EMT or an ER person, mm-hmm. and they want to talk to me.
Yeah.
And I just tell them my experience, mm-hmm. because they're not quite sure, am I okay? Because that's what they're thinking. And I really don't want anybody to know about this yet. I don't want to talk to anybody about it. So one of the other goals of the video conferencing is if somebody out there wants to see a first responder group, but they want total confidentiality, one of the ideas is to give them a passcode that they can come into a group, any group in the United States they want to come that agrees for someone on the outside to come into, and watch for 1 hour,
mm-hmm.
and then that security code expires.
Mm-hmm.
So that's it. You're not allowed in anymore. But you still have a phone number, and you have a name of a person to contact. So now it's on you. And that's the key. You have to make the decision. No one else is going to make that decision for you.
Right. That's your do-it-all.
Yeah. You can't force them, but you can only give them a little bit and say, we're here if you need us.
Mm-hmm.
You make the decision.
Mm-hmm.
So it puts the onus back on them, which is very important, because if you are a clinician or psychologist who believes that I have to make everybody come, I have to make them become clients.
Yeah.
You go nuts.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's not, that's it.
Yeah. So we want to build this website, which is part of the video conferencing portion of it.
Mm-hmm.
But in the website, I want it to be a place for education too, mm-hmm. and a place for resources. So knowing, having experienced the psychologists and clinicians,
mm-hmm.
and going through the process of trying to find one that understands me, I think we should have a group that vets out the ones that we want to be on our website.
Okay, it's
basically, right. They will be qualified by us.
Mm-hmm.
Education, what kind of background they have, what is their specialty.
Right.
If they specialize in PTSI and they have extensive experience in that arena,
mm-hmm.
then we will ask them to join our website for $10 a month. To support. That way it supports the cost of the website itself.
Sure.
So if anywhere, this will be broken down by state and down by city. So if I'm in Kansas City, I can dial into Kansas City and click on it and go, here's the list of qualified people who understand first responders.
That you can, I can go see in Kansas City and speak with?
Absolutely.
So you can do the web chatting, you can do it this way, you can actually go and do one-on-one if they offer that.
Right.
Brilliant.
Yeah, so I'm hoping to start $1, one life. That's my goal. I had tried doing selling stuff and taking the percentages and donating it, and that just became a nightmare. Mm-hmm. And so everybody kept telling me, don't do that. You know, that's not the way you want to do it, because I had this business model in mind. And they were right. Again, being a cop, I know everything. And even though I have a very strong business background, I have forgotten some of the basics. And that's to listen to other people.
Don't
be a know-it-all.
Yeah.
But again, being a cop, your mentality switches very rapidly. You become ingrained in that. I know everything, and you will do what I want you to do.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
You know that.
It works in certain controlled environments very well.
Yeah, when you're out on the streets in a certain, but not in business.
When you don't know what's going on, it's probably something that you don't want to adapt
into
that situation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm converting First Responder One to a nonprofit.
Okay.
And that'll be done by July 1st
of
this year.
Okay.
So that'll make things a lot easier, because I've already found out there's a lot of money out there.
Sure, yeah.
That for grants and so forth. Mm-hmm. And people are more willing to donate to a nonprofit. Mm-hmm. And to buy the knives, that didn't work.
That's right.
So now I'm trying to find a group of volunteers to get this off the ground.
Great.
You know, so we'll start building up a trailer, you know, to pull to events. Mm-hmm. I've made some great contacts in the county right now who would love me to set up and talk to people and educate the public and see if we can start the $1 for one life.
And if people want to start doing that, it'll be open July 1st.
Yes.
And you go to, what's the website for that?
Oh, it's www.firstresponder1, and it's all written out. Mm-hmm. Oh, .com, too.
.com.
Yeah.
And there'll be a little donation thing, and what you're saying is just $1 a person.
Yeah.
It could be, and later, you know, for different webisodes or podcasts.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, you could charge for that if needed. But this is, $1, what's it cost? And it's going to fund these people all around the world that are lifesavers, that are putting themselves in harm's way, seeing things, need to get some kind of treatment just to stay level enough to continue doing the job they're doing.
Right. And it provides that connection that you lose when you leave a retreat.
And now you've been going since 2012, is that right?
No, I didn't start till 2013.
Okay.
Actually seeing somebody on a regular basis, you know, which I was fortunate because the city will pay pay for so many sessions for you to go.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got the funding to go to the retreat.
Right.
And so since then I don't see anybody anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I have the tools to be able to cope, and I occasionally go to a first responder meetings I go up to the retreat too. And that's my tune up.
Right.
Because I can listen to the whole thing, the whole process over again, and I talk to the clients as they come through, and I also talk to my other peers. Mm-hmm. And it's just kind of like, here's it is. It's a nice, safe environment. We open up, we talk. So it's kind of a nice thing.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And you have kind of the power now, you're coming in to help. You've seen these things, you're more versed in them, and you're actually helping these people out too along the way.
It's just talking. It's just being able to talk.
And that's,
you know,
so underestimated and undervalued in the society.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah. And I'm also taking a direction with First Responder One that's giving me a new direction, mm-hmm. away from being a cop,
mm-hmm.
and which is kind of nice. I enjoy, I love the work. Don't get me wrong. I love being a police officer.
Yeah.
But it's time for me to go. I want my age, mm-hmm. and I'm too many injuries, you know, and I don't want to be the one, get into that one fight that I'm going to lose,
mm-hmm.
and get my gun taken away from me or something,
yeah.
and get killed.
You want to takes one.
And it only does take one. Yeah. So and I can't fight an 18-year-old anymore.
Right.
So but I still feel that coming out of law enforcement, you have value. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not just you did 30 years and then there's nothing else left. And I see a lot of officers do that. And they don't go into other things. Some do, some don't. But I think it's starting to change, which is good. You're starting to realize that once you take the uniform off, you need to understand that you're not a police officer anymore. So starting first responder one is getting to be fun.
That's great.
You know, it's getting to be challenging. And I'm finding that as the more I talk to people, the more they understand first responder one, the more positive feedback I'm getting.
Mm-hmm. I look forward to seeing that up there in July 1st. I'll definitely be doing podcasts with you in the future.
Great.
We'll start the webisodes.
But that's great. I like that.
Oh, I think it's... Come on. This is fantastic. This is a great, great idea. And like people are saying, it's the missing link.
Yeah.
And I think just like what you're doing, talking about this stuff, it keeps you feeling regular. It's your checkup. It's your, you know, when you go to your retreats, it's like, all right, I'm still doing this. I'm still working. I still feel good about this, the things that I went through.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just a self-check. It's a gut check. How do I feel about that incident I went through? Still good? Okay. Okay. Still feel good. Okay. So let's talk about it with other people.
Yeah.
That and just, you know, helping out. And I've seen things. They're not crazy, but, you know, I've dealt with enough that just to help out and run these things, it feels like you're in control again.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And then, hey, here's something I can offer to this organization.
Right.
And I'm more than, you know, I'm 100% in.
Good. Love That's great. Yeah. Absolutely. It's fabulous. Yeah, because I really want to get... I just want to get this off the ground.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot to it. Because I think I have value.
Absolutely.
I think to tell my story, if somebody hears this and they are in stress, you know, they need help, we'll get them the help they need. We'll get them to the people they need to talk to. Safe Call is a great way to start. Mm-hmm. I actually have a phone conference call with them after this.
Oh, great.
So talk to their president, tell them what I'm going to do because I want to link to them and then be able to say and set them up with the video and see how they, if they're willing to do that.
Okay, so, great.
I'm just very appreciative of meeting you.
This has been great.
You know, thank you very much. I hope people out there will listen and be willing to help.
Get involved, everyone. Get involved. If you got stuff that you want to get off your chest, get in touch with me. If you have things you want to offer to first responder one, get in touch with me. It's all good. It's all for everybody. We're out here trying to help each other. And this is just, it's a great idea, Chris. I'm already thinking the places you can talk to people about this and get this point across. I think to the public is the key, too. So,
yes, I do, too.
Until next time, this is Ken Allen saying, if you got it, then use it. Ladies and gentlemen, Chris, thanks so much for coming on.
No, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah, and anytime, if you need anything from me, let me know.
Okay, I will. Thank you. I used to trust nobody.